Good afternoon. Welcome to the Holiday Stores. We broadcast from the Avon Old Farms Hotel. Come by, give thousands of dollars, maybe a toy or two, make lots of people happy, and come say hi, because we like to see you. First hour on Fridays, we start off with Michael Harrison from Talkers Magazine. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you, Todd?
Nice to have you here. I'm always happy at this hour every week because our little get-together.
It's always great to be with you. I look forward to it as well, and I hope the listeners enjoy it.
So it's been a rambunctious week in terms of impeachment and everything.
Wow. It's a historic week.
It's like the Trump show, and they keep trying to jack up the ratings all the time. So, you know, it felt like it was getting a little flat, so they threw in impeachment for a subplot.
The producers
really
and directors
refreshing.
Got together, the writers.
Yeah.
Well, there's no question that one of the biggest questions is, are people getting tired of this? As if people's attention should be in the equation as to whether or not it is a valid process. You know, how are the ratings? Well, people aren't watching it anymore on TV. Okay, let them off. It's crazy how we think in this century.
Yes.
I don't even want to say in this country, because I think this goes on all over the world. I'm more and more understanding Shakespeare's All the World's a Stage. And it's pretty amazing seeing it play out in this, the era of Trump. But I think that the Democrats are facing a lot of obstacles to having this work out in their favor.
That's what I think, too. You know, it could cut either way.
But it could.
Certainly the Democrats. I mean, one of the things this highlights is how totally disorganized our system of government is, which was the intention, you know, that nobody be able to manage it, that it have too many competing factions and that the power be divided so there wasn't one place you could go and rig everything. And that means that even if you're in charge, in theory, like Nancy Pelosi is, it doesn't mean she has any ability to manage what goes on with impeachment. She can just do her best.
She can do her best to see. Yeah, what it is, basically, is she can do her best to see that other riggers don't rig. In other words, we have division of powers. So we have, it's like watching a mafia movie. They're the bad guys and the good bad guys and the bad guys, but they're all bad guys. And everything is relative. So you pick your good guy and your bad from the bad guys, and they're all bad guys.
They're all bad guys. Well, I'm down with that assessment. Because, you know, if there are people around power, they just seem to be focused more on the power than they are on what the purpose of the power is, which is to produce things for normal people.
No, well, their environment, they're surrounded by other people who look at them as though they're naive if they really bring that attitude into the halls of power. They may have that on the outside that may help them rise up in the political ranks. But once they are in power, they're no longer an outsider. Sorry about that little noise.
I love that. It means you have somebody checking in.
What happens is I sometimes
Doesn't
forget
that sound
how
like
many...
the bell at the front desk?
I have to go take somebody to their room.
Carry somebody's bags.
Do you remember when bellhops wore those outfits?
Yes, I can see you in one of those outfits.
Uniforms.
Just right.
I once wore a uniform like that when I was an usher in a movie theater back when I was...
Did you really do that? You went around with the
the
flashlight to make sure nobody was kissing or had their feet
up? That was a power trip. That was a power trip, especially when it were kids from my school and I'm there in my uniform. And
they pelted you with popcorn?
Their feet are on the chair in front of them. Put your feet down, sir. Or necking, which we called it back then. Or any number of smoking. A lot of things went on.
Times have changed. There are nobody even sets foot in the movie theater from ownership management.
Well, yeah, movie theaters are far more utilitarian. It was a cultural thing. But back to the rigging and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're facing... It sort of hit me this morning as I was writing up the materials that I do in my job as editor of Talkers Magazine, and I came up with the term the Trump paradox.
The Trump paradox. Describe this to us. What does that represent?
The Trump paradox is the fact that, whether you like him or not, let's step back and be very objective now, that Donald Trump is an extremely obnoxious person, that his personality, you know, he bends the truth, he's a braggart. He boasts. He's just, he's, there are many things about him that are disagreeable to people. It doesn't mean he doesn't have loyal followers, and it doesn't mean that he doesn't have a certain charm, and it doesn't mean he's not entertaining, and it doesn't mean he's not funny, and it doesn't mean that he's not successful as a president. It just means there's something about him, and many of them are obvious, and I don't want to be misunderstood, so I'm not going to go on a list of all the things about Trump that are obnoxious to a significant number of people, but he is so obnoxious to so many people, particularly the opposite party, the Democrats, and particularly a large segment of the mainstream press, that they are so disgusted with the idea, they're so, I guess, deranged over the fact that this man is in the presidency and it's been building and building and building, that they at this point will do anything within their power to get him out of office. They don't even want to hear any type of objective overview of it. So that's what's happening, and it might even be to their detriment. Now, part of the paradox is the fact that there's something very honest about Trump's dishonesty. Now, you and I have talked about that. Mm-hmm. He's transparent. He can't get away with anything. He doesn't try. It's there. And if you scratch the surface on almost any major politician, especially if you go back into history, you look at Winston Churchill, you look at the founding fathers, if you really look at them under the microscope of scrutiny, you'll find that a lot of them were rascals, scoundrels, liars, cheaters, drunkards, womanizers, used foul language, engaged in all kinds of political battles to the point of punching each other out on the floor of Congress, even mm-hmm. shooting and killing each other.
Back in the good old days.
Back in the good old days before Donald Trump. So this is the Trump paradox. We are certainly better off with Trump than Michael Bloomberg in dealing with China. That's my personal political opinion. Every day, new statistics come out that indicate we're entering this new digital era with a booming economy that, although, what, 6-8 weeks ago, economists were saying there are storm clouds on the horizon and we're about to go down the drain. And
wasn't that funny? That was a good little lesson of how the media runs in its own little bubbles of something being real that isn't real.
Wasn't real.
They
it
were
wasn't real.
Determined no, we may were yet going have into a recession.
We may yet have economic downturns. It can happen.
We will eventually. But they were declaring it a fact.
Yes. So it's the paradox of Donald Trump. You know, who do
Wait,
you want?
So what's the paradox again?
It's the Trump paradox. A paradox is where there are questions that just can't be answered. What do you do about it? It's a conundrum.
The conundrum is, though, that his dynamic can't be changed.
The problem is it's very hard to have a president that so many people find repugnant, even though in many ways he's the man of the hour. He's a good president in many ways.
But
there are things about him that I do not like. But I don't think that he's done anything shady enough or dirty enough to go through this kind of thing that we're being dragged through in terms of impeachment. I think that you would have found the same for almost every president in our lifetime or before. Maybe Dwight Eisenhower was perfect.
Important, I think, is that people don't seem to realize that this has been done to them. That there has been an orchestrated effort to keep the response to Trump in a frenzied state and to keep everybody focused on his abnormal behaviors, his excesses that aren't public policy and aren't the result of him being president. The result of him being president is the economy or international relations. What kind of wars are we fighting? It's not his personality quirks. And they've worked really hard to make sure everybody's in a frenzied state and everybody's fixated day after day over the same idiosyncrasies of his personality, which they could have finished on day one, said everything they wanted, and then left us alone. And everybody would be way more happy because they wouldn't be bombarded with this sense.
And it could be settled at the, you know, at the ballot box.
Exactly.
Because I'm not giving him a pass for the nasty tweets and the insulting of people and putting us into a bad spot with some of our allies and, you know, his cozying up with people who are on the fringe of what is considered to be decent political thinking. You know, there's a lot about this guy that could be on the deficit column when you're in the voting booth deciding, do I vote for him or not, if it were looked at honestly.
Yes, we could just shrug it off for now and make our assessment next election, but we're not being allowed to. And I think that's the interesting thing that people should be assessing, but they're not, because they think this is normal and they think what's actually going on every day is what the news is reporting, as opposed to all the things the news isn't reporting that's way more important.
And the news has been chasing this. The news is chasing it. The news is chasing it like a train that just pulled out of the station constantly. It isn't on top of it. The news is frustrated by the pace of breaking stories, the many tracks of many stories, and its corporate need to have ratings and revenue. So it goes back to, well, should we cover the impeachment, or are people getting tired of it?
Oh, well, the impeachment. Let's talk about that when we continue, because this was a pretty interesting week. Michael Harrison is here. Stay with us on WTIC. WTIC, good afternoon, Friday. We're happy to be joined first hour on Fridays by Michael Harrison, talking about some of the big issues of the week, some of the invisible issues that are out there but you might not have thought about, like Kamala Harris and the Democratic race for the presidency, which is impacted by all the news coverage. As they say in Washington, the news coverage for impeachment sucks the oxygen out of the presidential race, and things like the dropping out of Kamala Harris go largely unnoticed. Michael, what do you think about her dropping out and what it says about the race?
Well, it certainly shows you the importance of money in the race, and she cannot afford to lose California when that primary comes up, and the number's not looking good for her, and it comes down to money. She kind of blew it because she was riding on a high for a while when she attacked Joe Biden in the first or second debate.
Yeah, I think it was the first one.
Yeah, she had a spike. But there's an inconsistency about her message. She is neither fish nor fowl when it comes to the main categories people care about. And she has a side of her that comes out that seems somewhat mean-spirited. I don't know, how that plays out with different personalities. Some people say it's a gender thing, and, you know, you say a woman's mean-spirited, and that's sexist. But there are a lot of men out there that are mean-spirited, too. I think that Donald Trump is mean-spirited, far more mean-spirited than Kamala Harris. So it's not a gender thing. But these are the things people are saying. And but it really comes down to she never was really able to get a message that resonated with a large group of people.
I think all those things, everything you mentioned, is part of her campaign and part of its confusion, and that she never established herself as who she was. She went, and the attacking in the first debate was a negative feeling about who she was. She was going after Biden, the old guy who everybody likes and on the Democratic side and feels some affinity towards, and who lots of minorities support. He's got the minority support, and she was trying to take that away from him. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of miscalculations. You can't go out and do that prosecutor thing to the people who are standing next to you on the stage and expect that it's not going to hurt your likability.
And doing, you know, again, Trump and his paradox, Trump was able to be the exception to the rule back in 2016 when he engaged in the worst personal insults of his fellow GOPers on that stage. But for the most part, you know, among normal people, it's a very dangerous game to play, to really insult and attack and be vicious with your fellow party members during the primaries, because people have a long memory and, you know, it comes back to haunt you. There's an art to debating when it is among the family, so to speak.
Well, that is an interesting point you bring us back to Donald Trump and how he announced and went after John McCain, and he was mocking and putting down his colleagues as he ran for the Republican nomination. But he didn't do it in this manner that felt like it was a part of a plan for how to damage. Like the hit on
Wow, are you right?
Joe
Absolutely.
Biden
Great
was just
point.
Was just a hit on Joe Biden that she and her handlers had thought up. And Trump doesn't do handlers. He just does his even-handed contempt for everybody who would oppose him.
I think you answered the question that I was grasping for an answer to, and I think you hit it on the head. Yes, she felt choreographed. She had one-liners that came at certain moments that she was waiting, knowing it would come up. And that comes across to people, especially on television, whereas Trump was just being Trump. He's an equal opportunity offender, and as a result seemed more authentic and organic and spontaneous. So one of the problems the Democrats face in terms of identity politics, which is part of their shtick, is that at this moment they do not have an African-American who's on firm ground to be on the next televised debate. Cory Booker has been having money problems. He also hasn't been able to, and he's an interesting guy and has a tremendous background. But he also is not connecting much. And you must have heard, you know, that Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts, who has had a relationship over the years with Obama, I think they write speeches for each other and are friends. And
I don't know if any of that's true, by the way, that those last two things. I don't know if there is any friendship there. I question it because the media has always said they're close friends. But the connection is that David Axelrod had this idea that he could elect a black guy of a certain profile to be president of the United States. And the first guy he tried it out with was Deval Patrick, running him for governor of Massachusetts, and it worked. And he took a lot of those same kinds of lines and speeches and used them with Obama on the big show, and it worked again. And I don't, so they've always said they're friends, and I never seen evidence of it, so I question it.
That's interesting. You might be right.
I don't like the media. The media repeats that all the time so that people are inclined to believe it's true, but they've never presented evidence. They've just repeated what they've been told.
Well, because I have never met, nor do I know either of these gentlemen personally, you know, I might have just been parroting what I heard in the media, like the rest of us.
Well, I've only met Deval a couple of times, and I never saw him hanging around with Obama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you might be right. And that's also another interesting insight. Point of this being, though, he's not getting traction. I haven't seen, you know, what's the saying, move the needle? I haven't even seen the needle, let alone.
Well, that's another curious thing. There was no premise for Deval to get into the race. I think he just felt frustrated because he hadn't gotten into the race because of circumstances, and he saw the opportunity was there because they need somebody like him. They need somebody of his profile, but he's not in a position to command attention. And he just got in anyway. Okay, yeah, we'll take a break for news. Michael Harrison is here. More conversation coming up on WTIC. WTIC, it's Friday. Todd Feinberg with you. Michael Harrison is with us. That's what he does. First hour Fridays, he joins in with us. It's holiday store time. We are here at the Avon Old Farms Hotel. Come by, say hello, bring gifts, celebrate the season, help the Salvation Army, do all your cool things that you do. And just come by and say hi. Give us a high five, a low five, a side five. All right, Harrison.
Is that where we had dinner once?
The high five?
No, the high five sounds like a place. No, at the Avon
Sideways.
Old Farms.
Oh, we
hotel.
Did, actually, Michael.
What a lovely place.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, for folks, no, I'm not there with him. We're connected by electronic marbles.
Marbles or marbles?
There are some marbles in the system, but no, it's quite marvelous. But
so I
was nice.
Just reading this delightful story about homelessness, and it's all of a sudden in really wealthy areas, like in San Francisco, for example, or Los Angeles, where they're really struggling with homelessness, and there is a lack of response that's kind of interesting. And court cases going on about whether jurisdictions have the right even to take somebody off the sidewalk and tell them they can't sleep there.
See, if I
You've
were
following
king,
these stories, right?
If I were king, I would make that the rule. I would not allow homelessness.
You
I wouldn't
would
allow it.
Have.
It's
and
a,
how
it's
would
appalling.
You deal with it, though?
It would be a priority. Whatever resources that we have as a society should be put to the goal for many reasons, including respect for human dignity and concern for our fellow human and respect for our property, respect for our cities, our towns, respect for our community space. I believe homelessness, meaning vagrancy, meaning loitery, meaning setting up any kind of situation that is a public nuisance, that is a health hazard for the people doing it and for people that have to live with it, what it does to the values of the community and all that, it should just not be allowed. Then you have to do something so as not to be inhumane. I'm not saying that the homeless are to blame. Some of them are mentally ill. Some of them are down on their luck. Some of them are fake. And some of them are just of a psychological nature that I cannot begin to understand. But this is what's served up by our DNA. We have all types. It takes all types. But we have to just not allow it. The idea of somebody sleeping on the sidewalk with newspapers and blankets and all kinds of unhealthy germs and bacteria and filth. That's the word I'm looking for. Filth is appalling to me. And I don't understand how we allow it. Why isn't it a major priority? Why do we tiptoe around this?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think maybe it has something to do with the nature of cities, where they become so big and impersonal, and the people who slip through the cracks slip through the cracks. And that creates one of those bureaucratic situations where it's not my responsibility, it's his over there.
Well, I mean, look, we all have a share in common space. First of all, we have an investment in it. We run businesses in our cities. We have homes in our cities. We work in our cities. We all have a common interest in it. Now, we have to have a place. Just round them up. Round them up. You cannot sleep on the damn sidewalk.
And you would force people who don't want to?
Yeah, absolutely. I would make it illegal to sleep on the sidewalk, just as it's illegal to break into a place or to... they're breaking into the sensibilities of a publicly owned space. You know, I'm going to get a lot of nasty letters on this one.
You are. But are you protecting the space from homeless people or protecting homeless people from being homeless?
Both.
So you believe that the society has a right to walk around on sidewalks that aren't being used as bedrooms or bathrooms?
Exactly, because the sidewalks are there, that we all pay taxes. What does the street mean? What does it mean when you look at a society and you look at the street? The street has a definite literal translation. It also has a figurative translation. You know, out on the streets again. You know, mm-hmm. I'm living on the, you know, I'm out in the street. Street people. The street is where we go when we're outside of the boundaries of our own castle.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're now all together.
So it's not personal space, it's public space. Those things
are
different.
Public space. And the public space should be maintained for a equal and mutually beneficial result for the public. And anybody who is lying on the sidewalk, it's just the same as if they deface the property that we all own. That they go and chop down a tree in Central Park, or write graffiti on the post office building, or any number of things. It's wrong. And we have enough. Look, if somebody's sleeping on the damn street and it's 20 degrees out and they're all bundled up, no matter where you force them to go, to some type of public situation that has been designed to get them off the street, they're better off than they are lying on the street. I mean, it's not like you're taking them out of a comfortable situation and putting them in an uncomfortable one.
I understand
how dangerous missions are. That these, you know, public places for the homeless are very dangerous. They're not run properly. People get their items get stolen. They get molested. There's all kinds of problems attached to this. So let me reel us back into the beginning of what I was saying and say we must make it a priority. And then we can solve this problem easily.
Well, so I'm a little unclear on whether you're... It sounds like you're coming from both the compassion side and the societal organization side.
Yes.
There have been people wrestling with this in the courts, and there was an interesting ruling. Like, I've been surprised when there are court rulings saying you can't arrest people for sleeping on the sidewalk. And that just didn't make sense to me, because it seemed to me the sidewalk as a public place, a place where traffic is supposed to be going by, walking traffic, yes, but it's traffic, that it would be reasonable to restrict people using it for other purposes. But then there was a court ruling that said you can't take homeless people, order them off of sidewalks, if you're not going to offer them an alternative place to sleep. That if you Yes. are saying people have to sleep inside, then you have to provide inside space for sleeping for those who don't have it.
Exactly.
Makes
we
sense.
We should
it?
Do that. Didn't you wonder a couple of days ago when it was freezing out and the storm was whipping through and snow was falling and it was, you know, horrible out? I said to myself, I wonder how my friends, the birds and the rabbits, are doing, because I'm interested in wildlife and animals.
I think the birds and the rabbits know how to handle it, though.
Well, I obviously do, because they survive, but it's pretty amazing. They never go indoors. They live their entire lives outside. And then I thought about the people that are homeless. Like, what is it like to be out there tonight? And it would kill you. So where do they go? You know, what do they do? There's nothing that could be worse than living on the street.
Now, hard to imagine. You're
subject to anything. So, yes, missions can be dangerous. You know, places for the homeless can be very dangerous. There are all kinds of stories, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. But just start with the premise that there's nothing worse than sleeping on the sidewalk, especially in a big city, an impersonal big city. And I'm just sharing my own personal views. My sensibility is that big cities are very 19th and 20th century in their design, and that the idea of big cities, the way, you know, big northeastern cities, Manhattan, parts of Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, some of these places have outlived their functionality. They have to be.
We have to start cities. You want to
big
redesign
cities.
Them.
We need to think this way.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by this. What do you have a top of mind thought about what's wrong with cities?
They're too crowded. They're too crowded with cars. Have you ever driven through Manhattan during a rush hour time? It's incredibly scary. And
now
they have bicycle paths, and people are getting killed every day in New York on their bikes. And then there are people who are being run over by bicycles. It's insane. It's absolutely, it doesn't work. And you know, you reach a point in life where you go, well, this is the way it is. Every day I sit in traffic. Every day I, you know, why? Let's at least acknowledge the fact that so many of our social infrastructure paradigms are extremely outdated. And not that we can go and change it in one day, but we have to start talking about it and thinking about it.
Well, I think in cities they are, and they're making changes. So the bike paths are ludicrous in some ways, because there's no room for them. And if you're going to restrict cars, you create more stress and make it harder for people to be pedestrians. And in other ways, it's forcing the reassessment that you want. And especially cities like Boston and other cities that grew up before there was urban planning and before there were cars, you know, you have streets that have trouble fitting a bus down them anyway, all by itself. So it's a weird thing to have to do, and it's expensive to think about. But cities are now being populated by young millennials who have different values and different expectations of lifestyle. And I think those changes are going to go on gradually, but it would be really tough to just look at a city and say, okay, we're going to fix it.
You're right about that. But in places where they're mingling the bicycles and the cars, it's at a very awkward and dangerous halfway point, because cars and bikes do not get along well in an urban environment.
And part of it is premature, because the cars are still necessary. The bicycles are a desire, and you're going into space that just doesn't exist, that isn't available to be shared, and requiring it to be shared for something that is providing limited functionality and in cold climates for limited times of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is all interesting stuff. It's very futuristic. It's stuff that we should be thinking about. You're right about millennials. They do have a different value. And one of the things that I find is intriguing, is a word you use, and certainly positive, is that millennials are not obsessed with car ownership. Now, I'm of a generation where I find the car to be utilitarian. I've never been the kind of person that has to drive a car to be status. As a matter of fact, I like to play it down in a car so that I don't bring attention to myself. I like driving a car that nobody looks at.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's to get you from here to there.
Yeah, exactly. But I like it to be a good car.
Yeah. But when you turn the key, I think.
Yeah, and dependable. But the car is, for our generation, a symbol of freedom. It comes with being able to get in the car and go.
Yeah, I'm not ready to give that up. You sound like you're ready to give it up.
I'm not that ready to give it up.
Okay, hold on. Let's talk about that, because I like that conversation. That's a really good one. Michael Harrison is here. We will continue coming up on WTIC.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409.
There goes Michael Harrison, racing by in his 409.
Wow. Them old Beach Boys. Wow.
They were something.
Imagine making all that money with a voice like this.
Come on. They sound awesome together. Those harmonies?
Yeah, they do, but they sound funny.
And that was the official sound of California surfing music in those days.
And they never surfed.
Jan and Dean and all that. Yeah, they were fake
Island.
News. They were
I grew up on Long Island where we had surfboards on our cars but never went surfing because there was no place that allowed it. Faux surfers, posers. But now the Beach Boys, poses. Everybody's gone surfing. It's like, wow. But it sounded great. Still does.
Oh. Yeah, it really does. This idea of cars, Michael, and a switch over to a culture where cars are bad and cars aren't allowed into cities. I feel that feeling of being an old timer who's not ready to adapt to that, because I want to be able to whip into the city in a car, pull up in front of a restaurant, put a quarter in the meter, be fine for a couple of hours, hop in the car and go home. It should be easy to partake.
It should be easy.
Otherwise,
but
people are going to partake. Are you ever going to get on a train to go somewhere other than to downtown Manhattan?
No, I like having a car. I like the freedom the car gives me to come and go as I please. I'm not subject to mass transit. But on the other hand, there are times when I would rather use the mass transit. It's all what you're used to. Mass transit also, the subways in many cities are dangerous. They're dirty. They're disgusting. Mm-hmm. They cram you into the sardine can.
Well, that's
in Japan, they actually have people whose jobs are to squish you in. They're
Come
called
on,
pushers,
really?
I believe.
That's actually awful.
When was the last time you were in a New York City subway during rush hour?
Oh, I don't. It's been a few years, maybe 4 or 5 years.
It's a pretty awful experience unless you like being up close and personal with strangers, some of whom have evil intentions.
Yeah, it can be smelly. It can be dirty.
Yes.
It can be scary. A little intimidating and squealy loud, roaring loud, and all kinds of problems using it. Absolutely.
So, but the idea of mass transit is a good idea, and
it's
a part of a city.
Except we are evolving, and if automated cars are coming over the next decade or so, then automated cars for everybody are coming. In other words, you can just call a car and have it come pick you up
exactly.
Wherever you are.
My feeling is, we picture the car, you own a car, like you buy a Honda or a Chevy, and you get in it, it's your car, you pick it out, and it drives for you. Ain't going to work that way. That is a paradigm that will not work. What's going to happen is if we do get to a point where there are self-driving cars, the whole country, if we have Google Earth, we can take it one step further and have a big national or international grid controlled by satellites.
Yes.
And the grid will be tracks, like trolleys, only you won't see the tracks. And every home will have a track that comes up to the front of it, just like a road, a driveway. and it'll be almost Uber-ish. You want to go out, you plug into your app, and the car comes and gets you, and it goes to wherever you want to go on the grid system. Mm-hmm. And it's not an extension of the automobile. It's an extension of mass transit.
And you're saying that the automated car isn't coming? Is that your point?
Not the way people are thinking about it, no. There could never be a situation where automated cars and driven cars operate on the same roads.
And why is that, do you think?
Because artificial intelligence and organic intelligence are not compatible.
But don't you think the automated cars will be better cars than the human ones?
Yes, but the human ones are going to be in the way. I said they can't operate on the same roads.
Yes, but I'm assuming that the problem would be that the automateds couldn't adapt to having humans around. But if they can
The humans and the automated won't work out well. Okay. There'll be accidents all over the place. You know, you know where the term Dodgers comes from, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
No, where does that come from?
Originally, the word was the streetcar Dodgers, or the trolley Dodgers. And it's funny that LA
has Dodgers.
You mean like
pedestrians running out of the way
people
of the
running out
cars?
Of the way of trolley cars?
Uh-huh.
You know, with the That's tracks and funny. the electrical thing that sticks up, and there were the wires over the roads, and these things operated. It's sort of like in San Francisco, the mm-hmm. The streetcars. They're very hard to control. If one's coming at you, it ain't going to stop.
Right.
So you have to dodge it.
Yeah.
So, look, these are all nice ideas, and I have no doubt everything will be automated. Everything will be artificial intelligence, but it's not going to be this year. It's not going to be in 5 years.
It's not
going to be way
fast,
off.
Is it?
I don't think that we're going to get rid of the car that quickly.
I don't think it's coming fast. All right, Michael Harrison, we have to say goodbye to you fast, unfortunately.
Yeah, but you've got a whole couple of hours ahead. Enjoy.
Delightful to have you here. As always, we'll see you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Take care.
Michael Harrison, Talkers Magazine. Go to talkers.com and see what Michael does, the trade journal of the talk radio industry.